Chapter 1. To Alexandria. On the evening of April the 3rd, 1853, I left London for Southampton. By the advice of a brother officer, Captain, now Colonel, Henry Grindley of the Bengal Cavalry, little thought at that time the adviser or the advised how valuable was the suggestion, my Eastern dress was called into requisition before leaving town, and all my impedimenta were taught to look exceedingly Oriental. Early the next day, a Persian prince, accompanied by Captain Grindley, embarked on board the Peninsula and Oriental Company's magnificent screw steamer, Bengal. A fortnight was profitably spent in getting into the train of Oriental manners. For what polite Chesterfield says of the difference between a gentleman and his reverse, namely that both perform the same offices of life, but each in a several and widely different way, is notably as applicable to the manners of the Eastern as of the Western man. Look, for instance, at that Indian Muslim drinking a glass of water. With us, the operation's simple enough, but his performance includes no fewer than five novelties. In the first place, he clutches his tumbler as though it were the throat of a foe. Secondly, he ejaculates, "In the name of Allah, the Compassionate, the Merciful," before wetting his lips. Thirdly, he imbibes the contents, swallowing them, not sipping them, as he ought to do, and ending with a satisfied grunt. Fourthly, before setting down the cup, he sighs forth, "Praise be to Allah," of which you will understand the full meaning in the desert. And fifthly, he replies, "May Allah make it pleasant to thee," in answer to his friend's polite pleasurably and health. Also, he's careful to avoid the irreligious action of drinking the pure element in a standing position, mindful, however, of the three recognised exceptions, the fluid of the holy well Zemzem, water distributed in charity, and that which remains after wuzu, the lesser ablution. Moreover, in Europe, where both extremities are used indiscriminately, one forgets the exclusive use of the right hand, the manipulation of the rosary, the abuse of the chair. Your genuine Oriental gathers up his legs, looking almost as comfortable in it as a sailor upon the back of a high-trotting horse. The rolling gait with the toes straight to the front, the grave look, and the habit of pious ejaculations. Our voyage over the summer sea was eventless. In a steamer of 2,000 or 3,000 tons, you discover the once dreaded, now contemptible, stormy waters only by the band. A standing nuisance, be it remarked, performing "There We Lay All the Day in the Bay of Biscay, oh!" The sight of glorious Trafalgar excites none of the sentiments with which a tedious sail used to invest it. Malta, too, wears an old, familiar face, which bids you order a dinner and superintend the icing of claret, beginning of Oriental barbarism, instead of galloping about on donkey-back through fiery air in memory of St. Paul and White Cross Knights. But though our journey might be called monotonous, there was nothing to complain of. The ship was in every way comfortable. The cook, strange to say, was good. And the voyage lasted long enough and not too long. On the evening of the 13th day after our start, the big-trousered pilot, so lovely in his deformities to Western eyes, made his appearance, and the good screw Bengal found herself at anchor off the headland of Clay. Having been invited to start from the house of a kind friend, John W. Larking, I disembarked with him, and rejoiced to see that by dint of a beard and a shaven head, I had succeeded, like the Lord of Geesh, in misleading the inquisitive spirit of the populace. The mingled herd of spectators, before whom we passed in review on the landing place, hearing an audible Alhamdulillah, whispered, "Muslim!" Alhamdulillah means "Praise be to Allah, Lord of the Three Worlds," a pious ejaculation which leaves the lips of the true believer on all occasions of concluding actions. We then mounted a carriage, fought our way through the donkeys, and in half an hour found ourselves, chibuk in mouth and coffee cup in hand, seated on the divan of my friend Larking's hospitable home. Wonderful was the contrast between the steamer and that villa on the Mahmoudia Canal. Startling the sudden change from presto to adagio life. In 13 days we'd passed from the clammy grey fog, that atmosphere of industry which kept us at anchor off the Isle of Wight, through the loveliest air of the inland sea, whose sparkling blue and purple haze spread charms even on North Africa's beldame features. And now we're sitting silent and still, listening to the monotonous melody of the east, the soft night breeze wandering through starlit skies and tufted trees with a voice of melancholy meaning. And this is the Arab's kaif, the savouring of animal existence, the passive enjoyment of mere scents, the pleasant languor, the dreamy tranquillity, the airy castle building which in Asia stand in lieu of the vigorous, intensive, passionate life of Europe. It's the result of a lively, impressible, excitable nature and exquisite sensibility of nerve. It argues a facility for voluptuousness unknown to northern regions, where happiness is placed in the exertion of mental and physical powers, where ernst ist das Leben, where niggard earth commands ceaseless sweat of face, and damp chill air demands perpetual excitement, exercise or change or adventure or dissipation for want of something better. In the East, man wants but rest and shade. Upon the banks of a bubbling stream, or under the cool shelter of a perfumed tree, he's perfectly happy, smoking a pipe, or sipping a cup of coffee, or drinking a glass of sherbet. But above all things, deranging body and mind as little as possible. The trouble of conversations, the displeasures of memory, and the vanity of thought being the most unpleasant interruptions to his kaif. No wonder that kaif is a word untranslatable in our mother tongue. In a coarser sense, kaif is applied to all manner of intoxication. Sonnini's not wrong when he says the Arabs give the name of kaif to the voluptuous relaxation, the delicious stupor produced by the smoking of hemp. Let others describe the once famous capital of Egypt, this city of misnomers, whose dry docks are ever wet and whose marble fountain is eternally dry, whose Cleopatra's needle is neither a needle nor Cleopatra's, whose Pompey's pillar never had any earthly connection with Pompey, and whose Cleopatra's baths are, according to voracious travellers, no baths at all. Yet it is a wonderful place, this Libyan suburb of our day, this outpost of civilization planted upon the skirts of barbarism, this Osiris, seated side by side with Typhon, his great old enemy. Still, may be said of it, it ever beareth something new. And Alexandria, a threadbare subject in Bruce's time, is even yet, from its perpetual changes, a fit field for modern description. The better to blind the inquisitive eyes of servants and visitors, my friend Larking lodged me in an outhouse, where I could revel in the utmost freedom of life and manners. And although some Armenian dragoman, a restless spy like all his race, occasionally remarked, "Voilà un personne diablement dégagé," none, except those who were entrusted with the secret, had any idea of the part I was playing. The domestics, devout Muslims, pronounced me an ajami, a kind of Mohammedan. Not a good one like themselves, but still better than nothing. I lost no time in securing the assistance of a sheikh, and plunged once more into the intricacies of the faith, revived my recollections of religious ablutions, read the Koran, and again became an adept in the art of prostration. My leisure hours were employed in visiting the baths and coffee houses, in attending the bazaars, and in shopping, an operation which hereabouts consists of sitting upon a chapman's counter, smoking, sipping coffee, and telling your beads the while, to show that you are not of the slaves for whom time is made. In fact, in pitting your patience against that of your adversary, the vendor. I found time for a short excursion to a country village on the banks of the canal, nor was an opportunity of seeing the bee dance neglected, for it would be some months before my eyes might dwell on such a pleasant spectacle again. Careful of graver matters, I attended the mosque and visited the venerable localities in which modern Alexandria abounds. Pilgrimaging Muslims are here shown the tomb of Al-Nabi Danyal, Daniel the Prophet, discovered upon a spot where the late Sultan Mahmud dreamed that he saw an ancient man at prayer. It is not to be supposed that the people of Alexandria could look upon my files and pill-boxes without a yearning for their contents. An Indian doctor, too, was a novelty to them. Franks they despised, but a man who had come so far from east and west. Then there was something infinitely seducing in the character of a magician, a doctor, and fakir, each admirable of itself, thus combined to make great medicine. Men, women, and children besieged my door, by which means I could see the people face to face, and especially the fair sex, of which Europeans, generally speaking, know only the worst specimens. Even respectable natives, after witnessing a performance of Mandal and the Magic Mirror, opined that the stranger was a holy man gifted with supernatural powers and knowing everything. One old person sent to offer me his daughter in marriage. He said nothing about dowry, but I thought proper to decline the honour. And a middle-aged lady proffered me the sum of 100 piastres, nearly £1 sterling, if I would stay at Alexandria and superintend the restoration of her blind left eye. But the reader mustn't be led to suppose that I acted without any knowledge of my trade. From youth I've always been a dabbler in medical and mystical study. After a month's hard work at Alexandria, I prepared to assume the character of a wandering dervish. After reforming my title from Mirza, or Mister, to Sheikh Abdullah, a reverend man whose name I do not care to quote, some time ago initiated me into his order, the Qadiriyya, under the high-sounding name of Bismillah Shah, or King in the name of Allah. And after a due period of probation, he graciously elevated me to the proud position of a murshid, or master, in the mystic craft. I was, therefore, sufficiently well acquainted with the tenets and practices of these Oriental Freemasons. No character in the Muslim world is so proper for disguise as that of the dervish. It is assumed by all ranks, ages, and creeds, by the nobleman who has been disgraced at court, and by the peasant who is too idle to till the ground, by Dives who is weary of life, and by Lazarus who begs his bread from door to door. Further, the dervish is allowed to ignore ceremony and politeness as one who ceases to appear upon the stage of life. He may pray or not, marry or remain single as he pleases, be respectable in cloth of frieze as in cloth of gold, and no one asks him, the chartered vagabond, why he comes here or wherefore he goes there. He may wend his way on foot alone, or ride his Arab mare followed by a dozen servants. He is equally feared without weapons as swaggering through the streets armed to the teeth. The more haughty and offensive he is to the people, the more they respect him. A decided advantage to the traveller of choleric temperament. In the hour of imminent danger, he has only to become a maniac and he's safe. A madman in the East like a notably eccentric character in the West, is allowed to say or do whatever the spirit directs. Add to this character a little knowledge of medicine, a moderate skill in magic and a reputation for caring for nothing but study and books, together with capital sufficient to save you from the chance of starving, and you appear in the East to peculiar advantage. The only danger of the mystic path is that the dervish's ragged coat not unfrequently covers the cutthroat, and if seized in the society of such a brother, you may reluctantly become his companion under the stick or on the stake.